If you're familiar with the book, Where the Red Fern Grows, how many of you are, by the way? Anybody read that? The kids read it, maybe? All right. So it's a good book. It's a good book about early life here in America. And it's claimed in the book that by placing a shiny object like a piece of tinfoil inside a small hole in a log, a raccoon will reach in, squeeze its hand into a fist around that piece of tinfoil, and get stuck. The premise is that raccoons are too stubborn and greedy to let go of the prize, even to free themselves. And whether or not that's actually true for raccoons doesn't matter, because it is true for humans in a very real way. Perhaps not in the most literal sense. I think most people would turn loose of something if they know the hand could get out, then they'd go find something to dig it out with, because they wouldn't give up on it. But in a metaphorical way, that illustrates the point, and that is that we often pick the shiny thing over God, no matter the consequences. As the old country song says, if loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right. That's the kind of attitude and mentality that human beings tend to have. Because the reality is quite simple. Humans are greedy for shiny things like money, power, and sexual gratification, which is why our lesson tonight is, ooh, shiny. From 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 3, and verses 10 and 11, and verses 13 and 14. Because in those passages, Peter is listing the three primary motives of false teachers as money, power, and sex. Now, so far in our study of the false teachers from 2 Peter 2, we've covered the methods and the message. And tonight is about the motive. And I've saved our discussion of motives for tonight for two reasons. First of all, is that Peter discussed the method and the message first in verses 1 and 2. Let's read 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. It says, but false prophets who arose among the people, just as also arose among the people, just as there will also be false teachers among you, who will secretly introduce destructive heresies. And that word secretly introduce or cleverly teach, as some versions say, is the method. That's how they do it. They sneak it in. They use subtlety. They don't come in and say, well, I'm teaching doctrine X. I know that the Bible says Y, but I'm going to teach X. And everybody says, oh, okay, that's cool, that's fine. No, they come in and they try to make X sound like Y, because they can sneak it in that way. And so that's the method that they do, that they use to bring it in. And then the destructive heresies is the message. Or, as I said at the end of verse 2, the way of truth will be maligned because of these doctrines that they bring in. And that's what he says, many will follow their sensuality, and because of them the way of the truth will be maligned. And so you see the method and the message there are the first two things that he covers. We're going to look at tonight the motives here beginning in verse 3. And while he only hinted at it with the phrase evil teaching and shameful immorality back there in verse 2, Peter boldly claimed that their motives were these three things. He said greed, first of all, in verse 3. Let's read verse 3. And in their greed... So he's saying this is what they're driven by, this is their motive. If they're greed, they will exploit you with false words. Their judgment from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep. And then down in verses 10 and 11, he talks about the motive of power. Look at verse 10. He talks about those, and he refers back to indulging the flesh, which is the sex that we'll talk about in a moment, and his corrupt desires. And notice at the end of that, right there in the middle of the verse, despise authority. The idea there is of refusing to be told what to do, rejecting anyone having the right to tell them what they can and cannot do, because they want the power to decide what is right or wrong. Going on in verse 10, he says, daring, self-willed, they do not tremble when they revile angelic majesties, whereas angels who are greater in might and power do not bring a reviling judgment against them before the Lord. And so they think themselves better than angels, more powerful than angels, and do things that angels didn't do, even though angels have more power than humans. They will attack and accuse anybody teaching doctrines they don't like. And then in verses 13 and 14, he touches on the sexual aspect of it. Verse 13, he says, suffering wrong is the wages of doing wrong. They count it a pleasure to revel in the daytime. They are stains and blemishes, reveling in their deceptions as they carouse with you, having eyes full of adultery that never cease from sin, enticing unstable souls, having a heart trained in greed. He brings up greed again. Accursed children. And so he points out these three major motives, greed, power, and sex, there in this chapter. And then the rest of the chapter, he just kind of hammers away at this point, proving that these are the things that drive these false teachers. And we'll talk about these three things a little bit more in a moment. But I want us to look at the second reason I bring up motives last. And that's because it's the least important of these three problems with false teachers. And it's likely to cause pointless fights. I don't know. A couple of times I've made statements that people assume that I was questioning people's motives, and I get slapped back with, "You don't know their motives." Okay, maybe I don't, but I know their method and their message. I know how they're acting, and they're acting the way they're conducting themselves is implying that they don't have good motives. But it turns into a fight. So it's easier just to point out this is what they do and this is what they say, without getting into an unnecessary fight over why they're doing what they do and saying what they say. Because really, if a teacher's method and message are contrary to the gospel, that is, that person is secretly introducing destructive heresies, does it really matter if we know why they're doing it? Not really. It doesn't matter if we know why. I mean, it may be good to know why, because maybe if we understand the motive, we can address the motive and perhaps get them to thinking straight. Rather, because if we understand why they're doing it, we can maybe have a better answer or better way of discussing with it. But it really doesn't matter in the end whether we know their motives, because oftentimes, many a man who we would consider a sound teacher hides bad motives behind a facade of truth. Also, who's the ultimate judge? God. God's the ultimate judge. He knows the motives. He knows what they're thinking and why they're doing what they're doing, even if we don't. And so He is the one that will ultimately judge them, not us. And so while our motives matter greatly, I'm going to make sure you understand this, our motives matter greatly to us and to God. They are far less important to others. And so that's why I'm bringing this up last, because not only was it the last one mentioned, it's also the least important. But since our methods and our motives matter to God, let's examine the three motives here in chapter 2, 2 Peter 2, and examine our own hearts to make sure that we are operating and acting from proper motives, that we have the right motives in our actions and our work for the cause of Christ. And the first thing is greed, or money, the greed for money, the desire for money. And the word translated greed here in verse 3, go back to 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 3, and he says, "And in their greed," well, the word translated greed means greed. Okay, I had to do that because when you look it up, that's the first word that comes up under the definition of the Greek word greed. But what it really means is an intense selfish desire for wealth or possession. This is why I told you I was going to be talking about motives tonight instead of this morning in First Timothy chapter 6. It's often translated as covetous. Covetous is one of those big words that we don't use very much. We may use the word covet, but we don't use covetous much. It's more of a biblical word. And it's the idea of a wrongful desire. A wrongful desire based on not being happy with what we have and always wanting what others have. That's that hedonic treadmill that we talked about this morning. And so it's the idea of looking at other people and wanting what they have to the point of you're not content, you're not happy, and we're not willing to just settle or be content and satisfied with what God has provided us. And so as a result, what we do with that attitude is we exploit people. Go back to chapter 2, verse 3. "And in their greed, they will exploit you with false words." And that's plastic words, by the way, that word false there. They'll exploit you. And that's the idea of they'll make merchandise of you. They treat you as a product that they're buying and using and buying and selling and using for their benefit, for their gain. And it's the mentality of the attitude that looks at brethren and says, what can I get out of this church for myself? What can I get out of these various brethren for myself? It's the idea of looking at brethren and thinking, what can this person do for me, rather than what can I do for this person? How can I better their life? How can I improve their faith? How can I enhance their fellowship with God and with their brethren? That's the attitude we need to have. That's the motive that we need to be developing, so that we are not driven by greed or by the love of money. And that's the mindset that we need that overcomes this greed. Peter went on in chapter 2 to call this the way of Balaam. Look in chapter 2, 2 Peter chapter 2, in verses 15 through 16. Verses 15 through 16, he says this about Balaam, and he starts talking about Balaam. Now, let's read the verses. Verse 15 says, forsaking the right way, they have gone astray, having followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. But he received a rebuke for his own transgression, for a mute donkey restrained, speaking with the voice of a man, restrained the madness of the prophet. Now, if you're not familiar with the story of Balaam, I'll give you a brief background. Let's do a brief summary of it. The Israelites had come out of Egypt. They'd gone through the 40 years of wilderness wandering. They're getting ready to go into the promised land, and they're on the east side of the Jordan River, and they're on the border of Moab. And the king of Moab is a man named Balak, who doesn't like the fact that they're there. He thinks they're trying to take over his territory. Rather than just leave them alone, and if he left them alone, they would have left him alone. But he wouldn't have it, so he sent to a man named Balaam, who was a prophet of God, and said, here, I'll pay you money, come curse these Israelites. And Balaam asked God, what should I do? And God said, don't go, and because you cannot curse them. I have blessed them. So he got up the next morning, and he went and told the next day, and he told these guys who had brought the offer, and he says, I can't go. God told me not to do that. So they thought he was negotiating, and then so he went back and got more authority for more money, brought it back, and went back and forth a couple of times. And so finally, the money gets so big and the offer so deep that he's like, oh, I just want to do this. I want this. I want it. I want. I want. I want. It's the attitude that is obviously permeating his heart. And so he goes back and he asks God a third time. What do you say? God says, go. Just don't curse him. And so Balaam goes. And on the way there, he's riding his donkey. Turn back to Numbers chapter 22. I want to read a little bit of Numbers to give you the taste of this. So he's riding the donkey. And as the donkey is going along the path, God opens the donkey's eyes and lets the donkey see an angel of the Lord there in front of him. Balaam doesn't see it, but the donkey does. And the donkey's like trying to avoid the angel. And Balaam's getting angry, and he's beating the donkey. Look in verse 22, or verse 28 through 30. Let's go to verse 31. Then the eyes of the Lord opened let's go back to verse 27. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she lay down under Balaam. So Balaam was angry. That's the madness. He was angry and struck the donkey with his stick. And the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to Balaam, what have I done to you that you have struck me these three times? Now, I used to think that it was kind of funny that verse 29, Balaam said to the donkey, because you've made a mockery of me. If there had been a sword in my hand, I would have killed you by now. And I used to think, it's absurd that Balaam's talking to his donkey. But I think about how many times we talk to inanimate objects and animals and think that they were here, they know what we're saying and that they're listening to us. But if you come back to me and tell me that your dog or your pet talked back to you, I'm going to say, oh, okay, that's nice. That's the best I'm going to be able to do. But the donkey starts talking, And Balaam answers the donkey, because who's acting like a donkey in all this? It's Balaam's acting like a donkey. And in the end, they get to where they're going, and Balaam, instead of cursing the Israelites, blesses them. Balak gets mad and says, why should I pay you? I told you to curse them, and you bless them. And Balaam at least said, well, I can only do what God told me to say, or say what God told me to say. But in the end, he helped Balak, gave them some ideas of how to undermine Israel, and then helped their enemies. And so he died in Numbers 31, verse 8, in a battle against Israel. Balaam was killed because of his desire to serve money instead of God. I mean, think about it. We've got the Bible. We don't have God telling us to our face or telling us, speaking to us, here's what you say, here's what you don't say. And Balaam cannot get over the fact that he wants money, which meant more to him than the voice of God. And so that's the idea here of the motive. It cannot mean more to us than the Word of God. So Balaam sought to profit off of his connection to God as a prophet and died as a result. Well, that's the first of the three motives. The second one is power. And that is, power is the idea of despising authority and those who hold it as of little importance. Go back to 2 Peter chapter 2 and look at verses 10 and 11 again. In verse 10, he's talking there at the end of verse 10. They despise authority. They do not have any respect for God and His authorized representatives and His Word. They want to be in charge. They don't want to do what God says. They want to do what they want to do. And when you think about the curse in the Garden of Eden and the problem there when Eve ate of the tree of the fruit of knowledge, or the tree of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, is that was an attempt to become like God, where they decide what's right and wrong. And it's always, always, always a problem when we think it's up to us to decide what's right and wrong instead of God. And that's this idea of despising authority. God doesn't get to tell me what to do. His representatives, whether it's in the government or in the church, they don't get to tell me what to do. I'm going to do what I want to do. They're going to fight to be in control. And if they can't take over, they will fight everybody who's in charge. What do you see on the streets in many of the cities in America is people who don't like to be told what to do, can't get in control, so they're fighting the ones who are trying to enforce the law properly. And they're the kind of people who boldly say, no one is going to tell me what to do, while telling everybody else what to do, and never recognizing the inconsistency of that. They are like Cain and Balaam and Korah. Turn over to Jude chapter 1. There's only one chapter in Jude. And verses 8 and 11. In Jude, verses 8 through 11, Jude brings this up, talks about Balaam, and introduces another character, Korah. In Jude, beginning of verse 8, he says, talking about people who don't like to others to be in charge and want to be in charge themselves. Yet in the same way, verse 8, these men also, by dreaming, defile the flesh, reject authority, and revile angelic majesties. But Michael the archangel, when he disputed with the devil and argued about the body of Moses, did not dare pronounce against him a railing judgment, but said, the Lord rebuke you. So Michael exercised great restraint, whereas men who opposed him and follow Satan don't. But these men revile the things which they do not understand, and the things which they know by instinct, like unreasoning animals, by these things they are destroyed. Woe to them, for they have gone the way of Cain. So we know about Cain, who refused to offer the kind of sacrifice that would please God, when Abel offered one that pleased God by faith. And they know, when we talked about Balaam, and for a pay they have rushed headlong into the error of Balaam. We talked about that. And perished in the rebellion of Korah. So he's using three different examples of people who refused to do what they were told, who demanded the right to do it their own way. Korah, we're probably the least familiar with Korah because it's a kind of an obscure character back there in the Old Testament. But if you will, turn back to Numbers chapter 16. Numbers chapter 16. And this is during the days of the wandering. And you've got Korah, who is of the Levitical tribe and who is given authority to serve in the temple and to care for things that relate to the operation of the temple. But that's not enough. Korah wants more. He wants more authority. He wants more power. He challenges Moses and Aaron and asserts that he is equal to Moses and equal to Aaron, and basically says, who do they think they are? God has spoken to all of us. And he thinks that he is as important. Chapter 16, Numbers chapter 16, verses 1 through 3. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben. So you've got Korah, who's a Levite, and Dathan and Abiram are the children, descendants of the tribe of Reuben. And they rose up before Moses, together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, chosen in the assembly, men of renown. So they had authority. Then they assembled together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, you have gone far enough, for all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you exalt yourself above the assembly of the Lord? So they were challenging Moses. Then in verse 12, Moses talked to God, and then called them in verse 12. Then Moses sent a summons to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. But they said, we will not come up. You're not going to tell us what to do. We're our own independent free people. We can do what we want. You can't tell us what to do. Then in verses 25 through 35, let's read what happened to them. Then Moses arose and went to Dathan and Abiram with the elders of Israel following him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, depart now from the tents of these wicked men and touch nothing that belongs to them, or you will be swept away in all their sin. So they got back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan and Abiram, and Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the doorway of their tents along with their wives and their sons and their little ones. And I don't know why, but every time I read that, I imagine them standing up there at their tent with a scowl on their face. Who do you think you are, Moses, telling us what we can do? You know. However they were standing, that was their heart and that was their attitude. That was their motive. Verse 28. Moses said, by this you will know, or you shall know, that the Lord has sent me to do all these deeds, for this is not my doing. He says, all right, you want to know why I'm bold enough to take the position that I take and act with the authority I act? Because God gave it to me. Not me. God did. Verse 29, if these men die the death of all men, or if they suffer the fate of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord brings about an entirely new thing and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that is theirs and they descend alive into Sheol, then you will understand that these men have spurned the Lord. As he finished speaking all these words, the ground that was under them split open and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up and their households and all the men who belonged to Korah with their possessions. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive to Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. All Israel who were around them fled at their outcry, for they said, the earth may swallow us up. Fire also came forth from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were offering the incense. So all of the people that were involved in this rebellion against God, this insistence that they have their own power, that they have the right to do what they want, they died. They lost badly because they were challenging God. They were false teachers claiming to have authority or right to speak on behalf of God when they did not. So that's power. And let's go to the third one. The last one is sex. Sex is, and that goes back to 2 Peter chapter 2, and that's in verses 7 and through 11 and verses 13 through 14. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 7. Talking about Lot, he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of the unprincipled men there in Sodom. For by what he saw and heard, that righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day by their lawless deeds. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the righteous under punishment for the day of judgment, and especially those who indulge the flesh in its corrupt desires and despise authority. So they wanted to pursue sexual gratification however they wanted. No one was going to tell them what they could or could not do. Not God, not man, and especially not these guys that came in who were angels who came in with Lot into their city. Then in verses 13 and 14, he says this, and we read this earlier, they count it a pleasure to revel in the daytime. They are stains and blemishes, reveling in their deceptions as they carouse with you, having eyes full of adultery that never cease from sin, enticing unstable souls, having a heart trained in greed, accursed children. If you look over in Jude very quickly, in Jude chapter 7, and verse 7, and also in verses 16 through 8 and 18, Jude talks about this. He says in verse 7, but just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they in the same way as these indulged in gross immorality and went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example to undergoing the punishment of eternal fire. Then verse 16, he says they follow after their own lusts. Then verse 18, they follow after their own ungodly lust. The men of Sodom and Gomorrah and the grotesque things that they did are not the exception. Let me make this very clear. They are not the exception. A lot of people will try to defend homosexuality, will say, well, this was an exception. No, that is the inevitable end of where that kind of conduct and behavior and mentality goes. It will always go there. It will not stop short of that. They will follow after their own lusts. And if you don't think so, what do you think we see right now in the alphabet mafia? You ever heard the phrase alphabet mafia? The LGBTQ, et cetera, et cetera. It's a mafia. They are determined to destroy Western civilization, destroy any restrictions or restraints on their behavior, and they're willing to destroy the church and the country in order to do that. And it's clear, going back to verse 12 here in 2 Peter chapter 2, there are these like unreasoning animals. They act like unreasoning animals. They have no logic, no reason to their conduct. And so let's not be fooled by it. And I know we just finished up with the month of June where it's celebrated as Pride Month. It's a shame and a disgrace that we have a Pride Month in this country. It is shameful and sinful, and it must be condemned. Now, it must be condemned with clarity and kindness, and also don't leave out the heterosexual libertines, the kind of people who don't go after strange flesh, just go after whatever men who go after however many women they can conquer. It must be condemned. It's unacceptable. But unfortunately, this is what drives a lot of the people who are false teachers, because they get into positions of authority and use that to influence women to have relations with them that are ungodly and unacceptable. Now, don't be mean or unkind when you're talking to these people. But be very clear and don't be quiet. Address it. You may get called ugly names. They may spit in your face and yell at you and try to make you mad so that you'll retaliate and strike it. Don't give in to that temptation. But don't surrender to their ways and to their bullying. Well, Dennis preached on pornography a couple of weeks ago, and so we'll just stop right there and end with some takeaways. All right, let's end with some takeaways. How many of you remember President Kennedy's statement, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country? You can raise your hand. Anybody remember that? Everybody remember? Okay. Most of you do. Okay. All right. I'm paraphrasing that for our takeaways. Ask not what your church can do for you, but what you can do for your church. Takeaway number one. Takeaway number two. Ask not how your brethren can serve you, but how you can serve your brethren. And then the last one, guys, listen up on this one. Ask not if a woman is good looking, but if she is good hearted. We have a hang up because we're men and it's natural for us and we have to fight it to be focused on what women look like on the outside instead of what they are on the inside. And we need to overcome that. We need to defeat that shallow mindset and become focused on what they are on the inside. And we do that, then we can defeat the ooh, shiny mentality. So we conclude this evening with a question. Will you turn loose of the shiny, whatever it may be that attracts you, and even especially if it's false doctrine that the world teaches that tells you that you don't have to be baptized or you don't have to obey the Lord or any of those things, will you turn loose of that shiny object and turn to Christ for the salvation that Jesus offers? A salvation we can't earn, the salvation we can't purchase, a salvation we would not have if Jesus did not die on the cross for us. And so He did that for you and for me. And if you need to be right with God tonight in any way, we ask you, we plead with you, please come while we stand and sing.